This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Welcome to the award-winning Interest in Health and Safety podcast, making health and safety as important as everything else we do in business. And now your host, health and safety specialist, mentor and speaker, Colin Nottage.
Hi there, Colin Nottage here, and welcome to the Interesting Health and Safety podcast. A very short introduction today. I want to introduce you to James Pomeroy. James is the Group Health, Safety, Environment and Security Director at Lloyd's Register. And we have a really great chat about the way that COVID has changed our lives, changed society, and in some ways changed things for the better. But hey, have a listen and then we can have a chat at the end.
James, thank you so much for joining me on the Interesting Health and Safety podcast today. Could you please just sort of give an introduction to who you are and what you do?
Yeah, thank you very much, Colin, and it's a pleasure to be with you. So my name is James Pomeroy. I'm the Quality, Safety, Security and Environmental Director for Lloyd's Register. We are an international assurance, certification and inspection organisation heavily involved in maritime and high-risk sectors. I've worked in safety for just coming up to 30 years in a variety of other sectors, including industrial manufacturing, construction, engineering, and also in aviation. So a wide body of kind of knowledge in different sectors. And it's great to be with you today.
No, thanks a lot. I mean, it's an interesting career by the sound of things, and some fairly sort of higher risk activities that you've been involved with. But what one of the things that we said we were going to talk about today was basically the impact that COVID has had on the profession, but on society as well. And I just wondered if you can give us, maybe your opening views on this.
Yeah, so I was kind of early into this because Lloyd's is an international organization with heavy exposure to China. So I was getting into this, getting called into meetings and issues pretty much about mid-January of 2020. And then it really took over the rest of the year. But what was really helpful for me was being early in meant that we could then take the lessons and then apply those lessons to other areas. And we were always typically 4 to 5 weeks ahead of say Europe, and then when it went out to the Americas. So what that allowed us to do was to kind of forward plan and think, and even very practical things like start doing blackout testing, purchasing PPE, and just getting people ready and telling them this is coming and you need to start thinking about it. I think at that, a tactical level would be my experience. Taking a seat back from it and looking back at it now, 14 months on, I think, Colin, there's some really interesting bigger picture pieces to have, both in terms of some of the debates about safety that we go round at and we have about what theory is best, but I think also in terms of what some of the things that we've been doing, what's worked. And then I think also at the value and the valuation that business places on safety, people and the health of its workforce. So I think there's a number of perspectives to take there, but any one of those would be a very rich discussion.
I think, it's interesting, when listening to you talking there and, saying how you had this, you were ahead of the game, and I'm looking back now and thinking, people were very, very slow to react in general, weren't they? And I think that happens a lot in health and safety, doesn't it? That people, don't really see what is coming, and then all of a sudden it's on them, and they're almost engulfed by it. And that's how I feel that we've been a little bit with this, sort of become engulfed. And so, are you saying that we could have planned better?
No, I mean that's probably one of my lessons actually is nobody planned for this. In fact, for those that did plan for it, they threw all of their procedures out pretty much within the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But it's a different approach. So if I tell you that one of the things that we started to do early on in my organization was very early on, there was a tendency to control. So, panic. And that brings out a natural tendency in people to dial up the control elements. And we realized pretty early on it wasn't working. Mm. It wasn't working because, you know, Asia was at a very different place early on. Europe was just waking up to this, and it wasn't even on the agenda in other areas of the world. But also, the ability to control a global or any complex organization is almost impossible. Mm. So early on, we tried to say, well, we need to control this. We need authorization on where people work. We need authorization on when they send people home. We need to control this and that. And very quickly, it was a moment of truth to think we can't do that. And actually, I've always believed in an element of kind of earned autonomy, what I would term kind of freedom within a framework, which is that you set boundaries, yep. you trust people, and you say, either explicitly or implicitly, you say, these are the things that we trust you to do. And that's best espoused in things like the gold, silver, and bronze command system that a lot of organizations, and we particularly use, and it's common in military and in the police as well. But that is either done explicitly where you say that you can take these decisions. But in our case, we had it. We thought we had it, and we had to quickly learn it very quickly and question ourselves and say, no, we shouldn't be making that decision. We should give them an outcome we want to achieve, and then how they get there is up to them.
And I love that. And it's interesting you say that. I was in a meeting this morning. It's like a networking meeting, and one of the people in the network is an IT equipment provider, and he was saying that, you know, they're getting more calls for people to actually start to put monitoring systems onto the computers to actually make sure that people are sitting at their desks doing their working from home. Yeah. And I was sitting there thinking, oh my God, you know, we are going down such the wrong route here. You know, we're going back to where we used to be, you know, which was where, you know, you're making people, you know, sit in these, you know, the at these desks for these set times, which is how work used to be. But then hasn't the last year taught us that in actual fact, you know, what we want to be saying is that we want to achieve this kind of work. This, as you say, this is the outcome that we want to achieve. And if you achieve it by doing it that way, or you achieve it by doing it this other way, then does it matter? You know, as long as we get the successful outcome.
I think so. I think one of the elements coming through the pandemic is trust. It's a theme. There are themes that having spoken to a number of kind of safety practitioners around the world who've experienced this firsthand, one of those common themes is about trust. And it's kind of interesting, as having a conversation with someone the other day who gave a very similar example to you, to say, we've been through this process where we've trusted people to say, work from home. We don't need to monitor you. If you need to respond to your kids, or you need to kind of work at 8 o'clock in the evening rather than during the day because you've got a homeschool, don't care. Mm. And we trust you to get on with it. And what seems to be happening in some organizations is I'm hearing some stories of people saying, no, we demand you come back to the office. We demand that you're online from 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock. And you kind of think, no, that's just not the way I think culture of an organization should work. We've shown that organizations can. In fact, organizations like Lloyd's, we're actually far more efficient. And we've got better quality results. Our incident rates are down because people are driving less. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's a factor of how much they're, you know, risk they're actually exposed to. But when you look at the number of our metrics, whether they're profit, whether they're quality metrics or safety metrics, data has improved. So why wouldn't you trust people to do and to work from home more, or to work more flexibly, should we say?
So how do we go about influencing then the business leaders that maybe haven't got the, because it almost to me sounds like a confidence thing, you know, a confidence in letting people carry on as they are. How would you go about dealing with that then, or how have you been successful within your organization of maintaining that?
I think a lot of it is actually listening to the voice of employees. We talk a lot about the voice of customer and quality, but the voice of employees is particularly important. What are they actually saying, either through surveys or anecdotally, or through social media, things like Yammer and other kind of channels that people use, and just listening to what they're saying, because that in itself will tell you. And if people are saying, and we did a fair few number of surveys about 4 to 5 months into the pandemic, and people were telling us very clearly, we don't want to go back to work in the office 5 days a week. We don't want to go back to set hours. We want a degree of flexibility. So we had to have a whole program about ways of working. And that came fundamentally from listening to the voice of the employee and hearing what they were saying and recognizing, quite frankly, that morale would go down and turnover would rise if we didn't. But there's not only a diversity and inclusion element to this, there's an issue about attracting future talent because people don't want to work in an environment where the mechanics of how they work are dictated upon them. They want to work on a basis where they have a degree of trust, where they're trusted to do what they want. And as long as they achieve their objectives and as long as they contribute in a team, then let them get on with it. That fundamentally for me is what this concept of freedom within a framework is about, is about trusting people. And yes, there are processes to go through if people abuse that trust, but we shouldn't measure the majority on the minority.
I really agree with that. And, you know, and it's just to me, you know, having video recording just sounds so draconian, you know, and it's
frightening.
It's awful, isn't it? It's just really awful. And I really hope, you know, I hope that people who have got the opportunity to work where they want to work, and not everybody has, you know, but people who have, you know, make the right calls. And if there's organizations there that, you know, that are imposing that kind of stuff, that they still steer clear of that. What I find interesting as well is, again, I was chatting to another client this morning, and they've got some offices down near in Wimbledon in South London, and I was just saying, I said, what are you doing with that? Are you going to be selling the premises, or are you going to be going back in? They said, no, we're going to be going back in, but probably just a couple of days a week, and what that actually allows me. So what it allows us to do, he says, it actually allows us to increase our size of our employees without having to increase the size of our premises, you know, because we can start to stagger, you know, when people go in, so we can use that space, you know, in a more efficient way. And you know, and I just thought, what a lovely idea. And they said, you know, and when they've spoken to their employees, people do actually want to get back in a certain amount, you know, not necessarily 5 days, but you know a couple of days in and 3 days out of the office. They're thinking that actually sounds a nice balance. And I thought, great. And it was lovely to hear them talking that way.
Yeah, I go into the office not every week, but every other week, perhaps for 2 days.
Yeah.
It completely breaks the week up, and the spontaneity of bumping into people and actually just speaking to people I hadn't seen for a while, because, you know, Zoom and team meetings are really good, but they're organized, they're structured. The interaction of just saying, what are you working on and how are you doing, and having that conversation in an ad hoc way, that's the element of innovation. And I think particularly in safety and risk, we need it. We need it because we often don't need to speak to the finance people, or perhaps we don't need to speak to the marketing because they're not our natural kind of bedfellows, should we say. But you also need to know what people are doing in other teams, because that gives you ideas and inspiration. And we are a social kind of community within safety and risk, where we're trying to influence people and we're trying to learn what they're doing. So we're not going to be effective if we're working remotely. We do need that balance, and we need to be out there, particularly listening to people's concerns, issues, whether that's worries, concerns, anxiety, or actually hearing about things that they think are good and are working well that we need to do more of.
No, definitely. I think the other thing that I've noticed as well is the, you know, the sort of the supervisory and sort of middle management role hasn't been as present in operations where there's people that are doing things, you know, so in construction and say some manufacturing. And it hasn't, from what I've seen, it hasn't been detrimental, you know, so people don't need that constant supervision, you know, and it's, you know, I don't know. Have you got a view on that at all?
Yeah, I think I have actually. I think this probably a little bit controversial, but I think people are overmanaged. When the CEO of Rolls-Royce went in there, a guy called Warren East, he introduced the phrase called overmanaged and overlayered. And what he was saying is there's too many tiers and people are overmanaged in quite an extent. And it's something that I, as difficult as it is to have those conversations with people and the impact that it means, I do believe in a flatter kind of structure. We're going for a process at Lloyd's at the moment with some personnel where we are having to look at structures. And I've long believed that pyramid kind of hierarchical structures are really problematic. Mm-hmm. They're problematic because everybody should be working in a basis where there's only really two or three links from someone who's making senior decisions for those who are impacted by it. Mm-hmm. But there's also an innovation and a diversity and inclusion and empowerment issue to all of that as well, which is that people need to make mistakes and they need to be able to have those mistakes because it's, to be honest, we learn most by the errors and acts and omissions. Mm-hmm. And as long as they don't come with a cost of someone being injured or some kind of unethical practice, then we need to recognize that success and greatness doesn't come through reading a book. It comes through making errors. And if people are overmanaged, it stifles innovation. So I think there's really something important we need to get to, which is, If we accept this idea of trust that's coming out of the pandemic, one element of that is about where they work. And the second part is how they work, and how they work is as much about hierarchies and structures. Mm. And I think we're going to go through a process of looking at layers in organizations, and that applies equally to safety and risk as well.
Mm. Yeah, I think, you know, getting a nice flat structure does two things. It allows the transfer of information to happen so much quicker. And, you know, there's less people hold on to stuff, going either up or down. But also for the decision maker, and I love what you said there. You know, that having one or two places between the person doing or being influenced by the decision and the decision maker, it allows the decision maker to actually get out to meet the people who are being affected by those decisions a lot easier, because, you know, it may just be that him going out with his direct report into the workplace, he's suddenly with the people that he's impacting with his decisions. So, you know, I really like that. So
yeah, it's something I've done for quite a few years, which is when I joined Lloyd's, we did have about four layers of hierarchy within our safety and risk structure, and eliminated a whole tranche out of the middle manager, out of the senior management, because it's not needed. There's a tendency to try and standardize when standardization isn't needed. Actually, what's needed is the complete opposite, which is innovation. And then also there's a kind of element of people aren't growing because they're not growing because they don't have the capacity to fail and to innovate. So we need to look hard at structures, and equally, we need to give people who are young in their career the chance to grow and innovate and try something different.
Definitely. And I like what you said there about not trying to impose this standard approach. You know, we just do that so far too common, and it's almost because it's like the easy option, isn't it? Yeah. for the management, you know, we're doing it this way. And you know, and you will have seen that, you know, we're working in an organization that spreads across the world. There are so many different cultures you have to deal with. But even companies that are in the UK that, you know, that have got a national approach, you know, the way that things are done in Cornwall is different to how it's done in Newcastle. And don't be frightened of that, you know, actually, you know, embrace it. I think that's the thing, isn't it? You know, and really.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are kind of lessons there. Some of the stuff we talked about with how we responded to the pandemic, which is, you know, give people a framework, give them an outcome they need to achieve, and then just say, get on with it and just try it. But I think, there's equally, I mean, it's a conversation we have routinely within LR, which is, you know, can we standardize that? And the question is, why would we want to? What are the benefits? Some things are good standardizing, you know, bring a degree of automation, they reduce, improve efficiency, but equally there's downsides to it. And we need to balance out where it's appropriate for standardization and where it's appropriate for kind of local adaptation. And just let people get on and recognize, I think, you know, I look at this, Colin, from a kind of an ecology point of view, and, you know, we're on this planet because of Darwin. And Darwin was it wasn't the fittest that survived or the smartest. It was the ones that could adapt. And I remember when I was with Senior, which was where a job I did before I was joined Lloyd's, the most enjoyable thing I had were going around to factories, and they used to kind of take you by the hand and say, look what we've done. we've invented this, or we've done this. And it was the pride that they had. And I could never have developed that as the group safety lead, because I can't come up with this stuff. I'm not closest to it. So you just absolutely take beaming pride and steal with joy and say, can I take a picture and share it with the other, every other factory? And that, what's really interesting is they took the idea and then took it to the next generation, and then someone else took it to the next generation. And you saw Darwinian adaptation happening in real time. And I think there's something in that about thinking about how we proceduralize and standardize in this kind of Taylorist approach versus actually saying, well, what is the framework of which people can make decisions? What do they not mess with? Things like life critical rules or whatever we call them. And then what are the things that we say, just get on with it. We don't need to have a standard onboarding process because every site is different. We don't need to have a standard way of, I don't know, even driving, for example, maximum period driving. You may say in some countries it varies a bit. These types of things are things that we can give a degree of discretion about as long as we're comfortable with it. But it's balancing out the risks and the efficiency trade-off, I think.
I was doing a bit of training yesterday with a company that's got, they've got 11 sites across the UK, and we were talking about induction, and we just broke them up into little groups, and I just said, I want you to really, you know, critique your induction document, and just come back to me with how effective you think it is. And the big message that was coming back from these people was, you know, well, it's been imposed on us, and it's not us. It's not us. This isn't our site. This is somebody else's interpretation of our site. And, you know, we want our site back. You know, that's really what they were saying. And I thought, you know, do it then. You know, let's make that happen, you know, and let's make you be the people, the custodians of that process. You know, like you say, there'll be certain things that you need to say, but there'll be lots and lots of things that you can bring in yourself. And that's the sort of the framework approach.
You've got to give people space for that. So one of the things I remember doing, and it wasn't a conscious decision. I wasn't some bright spark who came up with it. It was just serendipitously, we came up with a process for, I think it was for machinery safety or something. And we said, actually the things that the group to adapt, people to say, so you mean I now need to identify this and I need to think about that. And I think it's a way of doing it, but we need to question ourselves why we're standardizing versus why we're not encouraging some innovation.
My background is the quarrying industry. I've spent a lot of time in the quarrying industry, and one of the things that I'm really proud of that the quarrying industry did was like a best practice award. And it actually, you know, there's some absolutely amazing people around the country that have come up with some fantastic ideas, and they get awarded, you know, or rewarded for these ideas. And that's a really, really powerful thing. And one of the things that one of the guys came up with was a device for turning a 205 litre drum from the ground up into an upright position by hand. He could do it by hand just by rolling it. And he had it a slight, a 45 degree angle, this elliptical piece of metal. And he just rolled it round, and he brought this drum up to a stand. And I just thought it was so simple, and it was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And I just love stuff like that.
Yeah. It's fantastic what people can do when you actually just say, go and adapt, rather than putting a whole load of constraints around them.
One of the things that you spoke about was sort of how technology has sort of moved on as a result of the sort of COVID pandemic, and obviously, you know, things like we're doing now, people are much, much more comfortable with doing, you know, sort of face to face discussions like we are now over Zoom and Teams and things like that. But where else do you think it's sort of really moved on as a result of the pandemic?
I remember having a discussion about a couple of years ago. We did a review, must have been about 2019, on safety tech in LR, and we kind of did all this work. And I was speaking to a couple of folks and said the biggest challenge with safety technology is about the ethics, about people getting very concerned about sharing of data and privacy and so on. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not over that, but one thing we have become more accustomed with and comfortable with is this idea that technology is there for a betterment and the power of technology. So we've all got used to track and trace apps. Mm-hmm. When we go into restaurants or go into the workplace now, we're using QR codes. Many of us were never using QR codes before. If you go to China, they will actually have a drone that will fly with a QR code that will come and actually come out to you. So they keep the social distance in there. The government's announced that the passport for COVID is going to go on the contact tracing app. So we're going to kind of get used to that. And then some companies have gone a bit further. Some have started to use social distancing kind of techniques where they send alarms and say, when I get within 2 meters of you, it alarms. So there's a variety of things that are being done, some of which have worked, some of which haven't. But what's really interesting is how quickly people have adapted to them, and really got a lot more comfortable with them. So I think one of the silver linings come out of the pandemic is people's acceptance of technology as a betterment for safety. And actually, what I think the final kind of thing I would say on this is it's not always evidential. One of the things that's really struck me is we've had some technology being used that we know actually evidentially doesn't work, like temperature testing, for example. You go into an office and they scan your temperature, but we've actually had to introduce that to make people feel comfortable, to give people a sense of comfort. I don't think we should necessarily be afraid of that and just recognize that some things are introduced not because they're necessarily serve a purpose, but because they give people a sense of false comfort. But that's just one of the things we're going to have to accept. But I do think over the past year, we've become a lot more trusting in some of the technology. We've also, I think, and this is particularly relevant for the kind of debates going on about what we measure and how we measure, the public have started to see firsthand some of the problems with health data, whether that's data being collected in Excel and then people realize, well, that's not the way to do it, or whether it's related to the problems of what you measure and the absence of data. We remember early on all the problems about definitions. Well, we get into this constant cycle within safety about, what are the definitions, what things should we should be measuring. So there's a case study over the past year about data and measurement, and that feeds into technology as well. So I think it's been a really good thing for technology. And we have shown that businesses can transform because at Lloyd's, when we had a business that was probably somewhere between 5 to 8% delivered through technology remotely. We're now up to 50, 60% technology delivered for some of our products and services. That means, in essence, in a year, we've got some businesses like ourselves that have fundamentally transformed themselves and are able to deliver certain products and services, whether that's training or verification or whatever it may be, remotely. Now, that can only be a good thing for the environment and for people's well-being, able to kind of be home with their families a bit more.
No, I totally agree with you there. I mean, my business has been a classic example of that. You know, I used to drive up to Aberdeen. I used to drive to Cornwall, to Kent, all over the place. And now I'm doing. I still an element of that, but I'm able to do a lot more from home. But I think one of the downsides, though, that there has been for me has been the time to reflect. And you know, I would leave a site and maybe have an hour and a half or a 2 hour drive, and that would give me a chance to either listen to some music or listen to a podcast or just listen to the radio or whatever it may be, and get everything out of my head. And that element is gone, you know. And you know, because I'm now sit here and work, and then I go through my door behind me, and it's straight into home life.
You know, I heard something really similar about 2 or 3 months ago. Someone said, what are you looking most forward to going back to the office? And they said the commute. And I said, well, commute? Tell me. And they said, because the commute is my break. It's a physical break. And they said to me, look, my mental health and anxiety is actually worse now because I'm not getting a physical break because that blurring's happening. And I've come to recognize that sitting on a train for 40 minutes is actually really, it's a decompression for me. And equally, at the beginning of the day, I now come down and sit at my desk, and it takes me 40 minutes to get my mojo, whereas I used to get that on the train and be kind of pumped up, ready to go. So I'm not suggesting we go back to kind of 5 days and then 40 minutes on a train every day, but I'm saying that, you mix it up a bit, and it's the diversity and difference, I think, that makes for that. And so I agree with you, whether it's being in a car or being on a train, having a physical break creates that series of reflection and thinking, Perhaps I didn't approach that right, or perhaps I didn't perhaps look at that right, or maybe I missed that. Reflective points really come in those periods of transportation.
What I've done is I've introduced exercise into my life properly, and so I go out now and I will go for a run. Last night I did about 3K. You know, I often do 5K, and I've lost 5 stone in
since last
August.
That's incredible.
And it's it's amazing for me as an individual, but also I know that mentally I am so much better for that. And so if anybody's listening to this and they're in a bit of an awkward place, then just go to something like the Couch to 5K app, you know, and just start with something like that, and then just build up, and it will help so much. It will help so much.
I run sometimes every day, but typically every other day. And if I don't exercise, actually, I find myself, I can sit here for 12 hours a day and I'm actually far more effective to work normal hours, take a break, and then come back to it in the morning. And it's literally like that. So I think it's really important to do that and to take that time out, whether it's walking, running, riding, whatever it is, but just getting out.
Yeah, no, definitely take that opportunity. So, and there's some days, I've got a Fitbit on my watch, and you know, there were days that I was doing like 800 steps, and I was thinking, I've been nowhere. You know,
find that though? Because for me, so I used to have a Fitbit, and there's a bit of a story to this. I found I was performance managing myself, and the metric, whether it's a sleeping app or a running app or whatever it may be. But I found that I was target setting myself. And then I said, actually, it's the process of, you know, I was getting more worried about not getting enough sleep and not taking enough steps than I was about thinking, we'll just go for a walk. Whether you walk 4,000 or 5,000, or we'll just go for a run, whether you do it in 20 minutes or 30, it doesn't matter. It's the process rather than the outcome. So for me, it's kind of interesting. I gave up on the metrics, and I'm kind of anti-metrics now as a consequence.
Right. Okay, right. Now, I think everybody's probably different. I actually need, you know, I have needed those targets. I've needed the discipline, you know. Yeah. And so there's been things that I've been challenging myself with, doing a certain number of steps, eating the right way, drinking the right amount of water has worked for me. But what it's done though is I used to be really rigid. I am much, much more comfortable knowing what I need to do. And I know, and my wife knows when I need to go for a run, you know, and she'll say,
you know, just tells you that all the time, Colin, you need to leave.
Yeah. Get yourself out.
That's the beginning of an argument at that point. She says, here's your running shoes, out you go.
I used to go and see a guy called Jerry, who was a bit of a life coach, and a really, really lovely guy. We still talk, and it used to be my chance to sort of get everything off my chest. And I can remember once having a discussion with my wife. I say discussion in the nicest frame. And she just shouted at me, "You've got to go and effing see Jerry."
I got to share something because it is so similar, right? So when I used to travel a lot, in my last one, I don't travel anywhere near as much as I used to, but when I used to travel a lot, and we're going back about a decade now, and it was kind of every 2 weeks, every month, I came back and I was really cranky after some long haul flight back from the US, and I put my bags down, and my kids were kind of, must have been about 8, 10, something like that. And I was, you know, like a bear with a sore head. And my daughter just did this in the kitchen. She looked over, looked at the planner, and started doing that. And I said, well, what are you doing? She said, I'm just looking when you're going away again, because you're getting on my nerves already.
Kids are great.
I thought it was a moment of truth. I thought, yeah, I really need to decompress a bit.
I just love it. I love the way they just talk. They just talk the truth. They just say it as it is, and they're not.
Yes,
they're
that boldness to turn around to their parents and say, "You're getting on my nerves already."
Yeah. brilliant. Where do you see that the sort of the health and safety professional then needs to transform or move or take things on board in this sort of new style, this new world that we're moving into?
Well, I think we certainly need to embrace well-being. It's absolutely key. And I think we need to really think about it. And the examples you've given about, you know, how your life has transformed through physical exercise and how that affects our mental health, I think that's fundamental. Mm-hmm. The evidence on the link between safety and well-being isn't as clear as it could be, but it will be. Mm-hmm. I think we all know anecdotally it's there. And that kind of takes us into that discussion about resilience as well. So I think firstly, we've got to kind of look at this whole piece about well-being and actually really rethink about reframing what we do. I think the second thing that we need to do, we need to take a lesson over the past year and think about what's worked. And fundamentally what's worked are concepts around trust that we've talked a lot about. Mm-hmm. I think this idea about creating capacity and agility, which are very much in with the new view of safety. I mean, if ever you've wanted an example of the new view of safety, you've had it, because mm-hmm. nobody had we didn't have a procedure, and those that did have a procedure threw them away. That tells you enough about procedures and process, that mm-hmm. they're there as a planning tool, but then they're not really that effective mm-hmm. when the rubber hits the road. So there's something there about the ability to plan and the process of planning versus documenting. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something in that we really need to think about, which is how we create resilient teams that work well together. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we need to think about that. I think about the third element I would really focus on, that perhaps is a little controversial, is about value, about where the value is in the organization. You know, I've had a real kind of moment of truth over the past year when our frontline personnel have been called by the Prime Minister essential workers. Mm. You know, when you're the guys and girls in the coveralls have been called key by society, that really tells you where they see value, mm-hmm. And where the value is in the organization. And it may not be in the hierarchies or in who gets the private car park or the office. And that makes us think about how we reconnect with our workers. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something really important there for us to think about within who are we there to serve. Mm-hmm. It may be the senior management who's paying our money, but actually we are fundamentally there to serve, to listen to, and to respond to the needs of the frontline personnel. Now, if we accept that there's a customer relationship, then we perhaps need to think about how we engage with them a bit more, mm-hmm. and not think that we're the expert. I mean, the idea, I'm not a marine surveyor. Now, I work for an organization that does marine surveying, so I have to listen to their expertise, and they do somewhere in the region of 32 to 34,000 surveys per year. They may do somewhere about 24 to 26,000 confined space entries a year. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't do that. So as an individual serving them as customers, and them as key workers, I really need to listen to their pain points and make life easier for them, and not keep telling them, well, you need to follow the procedure. Mm-hmm. You need to follow the procedure rigidly and try and listen to where their pain points are. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something for the past year about trust, about where value is in the organization, and then how we approach the management of risk, and not thinking all the time the solution, we can document it and we can listen from commandments upon high.
Yeah. No, that's beautiful way to sum up our discussion. James, I'm aware that you've got another meeting that you've got to go to very, very soon. Have you got anything coming up? Have you got anything that you want to tell us about? Or if not, you know, how could people get hold of you?
I think, yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. I haven't got anything kind of notable coming up. We're planning for a refresh internally of our quality and safety program. So I'm putting a lot of focus on that at the moment. Mm-hmm. But no, people reach out if they want to talk some more. And I'm happy to kind of share thoughts and particularly learn from other people's insights as well. Mm. One thing I'm particularly keen to do is to hear other people's experiences. You've heard mine, yeah. But what are your experiences over the past year? And what do you think about things that have changed or perhaps have changed you as a consequence?
No, that's a really good thing. So, hey, look, you know, thank you ever so much for your time today.
No, thank you.
Really appreciated having our brief chat, but really, really engaging. And, you know, I look forward to chatting to you again really soon.
Thanks, Colin. All the best.
James, thank you so much for spending some time on the podcast. It was absolutely lovely chatting with yourself, and some really insightful and thought-provoking issues that you raised, and in such an eloquent way. You know, so really appreciate that. You know, let's just go over a few of them. You know, I mean, trust is a big thing. You know, trust is a big thing in any business. But you know how businesses have had to react and allow people to work work in different environments. You know, we've really got to trust people and allow them to do their jobs. And I think what I like, one of the things I said is, you know, working within a framework, but let people get on with it. You know, and actually start to measure results in a different way. You know, good performance isn't about being at work from 9 till 5. You know, good performance is the results that you get. From the time that you spend doing whatever activity is that you're doing, you know, so be much, much more open and much, much more acceptable to that kind of approach. You talked a bit about, you know, standardization and local adaptation. And again, love those terminology there, you know, and we do as businesses try to impose, you know, the one way, the one size fits all, and it just doesn't fit, you know, so be comfortable with letting individuals on in organisations, on sites, in areas, you know, to be, you know, forward thinking, to look at what they can do outside of the box, as it were, and you know, and become you know, become successful. You know, some of the I work in a quarrying industry, and some of the things that people do within the quarrying industry are absolutely fantastic, and you know, and to allow that to happen. And then this whole transformation of businesses, you know, they've gone online a lot more, but also transformation of the profession, you know, the individuals within the profession, and with well-being such a major part of where we need to go to and where we need to move forward. Hey, you know, I've you know, I could say I've been lucky. You know, I've managed to apply myself and lose weight, but I've also worked bloody hard, you know, really hard to get the weight off. And the thing is you know, for me, it's always a battle. You know, I'm always battling my weight. I love eating food. You know, I love eating food and I like drinking beer, and you know, whilst I do that, there's always a risk of me putting weight on. So just getting that little bit of control, you know, thinking about what it is that you're going to do, you know, setting aside time to do the things that are important, you know, I think is really important. You know, when you look back, you know, when you look back on your careers and your life as you get older, you know, we all realise that in actual fact, the important things in life are not chasing the money, are not running around the country. The important things in life are family. The important things in life are your health. And the sooner you can actually get that clear and actually work on that and make that the thing that is the real focus of Earth, you know, the happier that people are going to be. And, you know, and if you're happy, then the other things come. You know, the other things happen. Hey, James, just a thank you. You know, it'd be great to have you back on the show at some point again in the future. And, you know, and I hope people have got something of real value from this. Hey, we just want to hand over to a little message from our sponsors. The Interesting Health and Safety podcast is sponsored by Project Meletium. Project Meletium is a community for health and safety professionals. You know, if you're new to the profession, you know, or looking to get involved in the profession, if you've hit a plateau in your career, or maybe if you're later on in your career and you want to give something back, then Project Meletium is the place for you. We run weekly community calls on a Wednesday and a Friday. We have monthly book club and quarterly wagon wheels where we get to explore set goals and objectives. And it's a place where people share success. And that is one of the most important parts of what we do is giving people the opportunity to talk about the things that are going really well within their lives, within their businesses, just within their careers. So please check out www.projectmeletium.com and come and join something really special. Thank you ever so much.
Thanks for listening to the Interesting Health and Safety podcast. You can follow and engage on Facebook and LinkedIn by searching the Interesting Health and Safety community, or go to www.influentialmg.com. And remember, let's make health and safety as important as everything else we do in business. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company.
Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Colin Nottage.